Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 2 minutes after 9:00 a.m., January 24th, 2024. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, co-chair Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, and myself, Stedman. Today, we're going to have an, start our overview of the governor's FY25 budget. The presentation is going to be done by the nonpartisan Legislative Finance Division and their director, Mr. Alexi Painter. If he can come forward, please, take us through his slides. If we get through those today, this morning, fine. If not, we'll figure out at the end if we're going to pick them up this afternoon or pick them up in the morning to finish off this presentation. Mr. Painter.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Alexi Painter. I'm the director of the Legislative Finance Division. And I know I have a lot of slides today, so I will see how far we get and try not to rush through. So we're going to start by talking about an update on the fiscal situation more broadly, get into the fall revenue forecast, and then an update on FY24 before we turn to the FY25 governor's budget, and then get into the long-term view at the end. So this is a graph of the revenue and budget since FY19. And the reason to pick FY19 as the starting date is that's the first year of our percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. So this is essentially when our current fiscal system started, where that has been our largest source of revenue most years. So to orient you to the graph, the area graph in the background is revenue. The green is the non-petroleum or the petroleum revenue. That's traditionally our largest source of revenue and now is mostly our second largest source of revenue. The orange is the non-petroleum revenue. The purple is the percent of market value draw from the Alaska Permanent Fund. The bars in the front are the budgets in those years. The blue at the bottom is agency operations. That's the day-to-day cost of state government. Red is the statewide operations. Those are items that don't fit into agency budgets, like state assistance to retirement and debt service. The gray is the capital budget, and then the light blue at the top is the permanent fund dividends. And that includes energy relief payments as a permanent fund dividend, even though they're paid for a little differently in terms of the mechanism. So I think the notable things with this slide are that since we've had this percent of market value draw, we've had a relatively stable fiscal situation. We've run surpluses in two of the years, FY22 and FY24. We ran a deficit in FY18 through 21, and then again in FY23. The governor's FY25 budget again proposes a deficit. But if you look at our savings accounts balances, those surpluses have sort of made up for some of those deficits. We had about $2.7 billion in between the CBR and SBR at the beginning of FY19, and we have almost the exact same value, still $2.7 billion. At the end of FY23, based on preliminary numbers. So despite, you know, the sort of ups and downs through the years, our budget has been relatively stable. It's often said that we have a structural budget deficit. And what that means is that if you look at the structure of our statutes that are on the books, including the permanent fund dividend statute, and then compare that to our recurring revenue, we would have a deficit. And that's accurate, but what the legislature has actually done is sort of fiscal planning year by year, where each year we've balanced the budget roughly based on what we have available. I would note that the last few years we have not had access to the Constitutional Budget Reserve when the budget was initially prepared. In FY23, there was a supplemental vote to give CBR access. And so the legislature didn't have the option of running deficits the last few years because there weren't savings to draw from that we could. Had the votes to access. So that's caused relatively stable fiscal situation, but it's been by essentially varying the size of the capital budget and the permanent fund dividend based on available revenues each year. So we haven't necessarily achieved stability in that we have balance with our statutes and year to year, but we have achieved mostly balanced budgets the last few years, which I think is a big change from how it was before the percent of market value draw, as depicted on the slide. So So this next slide shows oil prices through last Friday, starting in November 2021. And so I highlighted in the last slide that we've had relative fiscal stability the last few years in terms of our where our budgets have landed. Oil prices, which are the most volatile source of our revenue, have not been stable. We've seen oil prices go from somewhere in the $70 range to a peak of about $125 a barrel. Even this year, in the fall, we saw prices nearing $100, and now they're back in the mid-70s to upper 70s. So we've seen a lot of volatility in our oil prices that has not really translated to our budget fully, although we did see a spike in our budget during this period when we had this big spike in revenue. But we do have quite a bit of volatility in that oil revenue. The legislature has responded to that by budgeting the last 2 years with these sort of sliding scale mechanisms where if revenue comes in higher, additional things would happen. So this year, and FY24 we'll talk about more, if the revenue came in above the spring forecast, then revenue went to an energy relief check in the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The year before, if revenue came in high, the budget would have put money in the Public Education Fund to forward fund education. So one of the ways we've tried to handle this volatility is to essentially build in mechanisms to deal with that extra revenue rather than just spend it if it comes in high. Going on to slide five, investments. So, you know, I mentioned the POMV revenue has been stable, but the actual investment revenue has not been stable at all. Investments are incredibly volatile. So this slide compares the performance of the permanent fund corporation's investments in the blue line to the Division of Treasury's investments. And we use PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System. That's their largest asset, just to have a clear comparison. Historically, the two are very close year to year. The average for the permanent fund is 8.67%. The average for the PERS is 8.53%. Going forward, PERS has a slightly higher projected return of 7.59 versus permanent fund 7.20 from FY25 and beyond. But they're very close. They're in the same range. But you can see that extreme volatility from year to year. And if we were just budgeting based on what we got from our investments that year, we would have a lot of volatility. We've built in a mechanism to smooth that volatility with the POMV draw, which I'll go over on the next slide. So Senator Hoffman last week asked the Department of Revenue to talk about this, so I just put it in before they come in. But this shows how the percent of market value draws are calculated. So this takes the year-end balance of the permanent fund, subtracting out the AMRAD Hess money that can't be used for that, and shows how the FY24 and FY25 POMV draws were calculated. So in FY24, it's a 5% of the last 5 years, excluding the fiscal year that just ended, so FY18 through 22, 5% of those numbers, the average number comes out to $3.5 billion. In FY25, it's the average of FY19 through 23, and we come out with $3.657 billion, so a little bit higher. Note that FY21, we had those huge investment returns you saw in the last slide that resulted in the value of the permanent fund spiking. If we had spent based on that, we would have had a lot more revenue, but because we're averaging, we didn't really see a big spike in our POMV. That's worked in over time. And part of the discussion when we talk about is 5% an appropriate number for our POMV, with the trailing average, the amount that is actually going out is not necessarily equal to 5% of the current balance as long as we have a growing fund. So the FY24 POMV value is about 4.6% of the FY22 value of the fund rather than 5% of that average. So it kind of results in a lower real or effective draw rate than because of that averaging, as long as the market's rising. FY25 is about 4.7%. In a couple of years, when we have that FY21 as our first number, it may look a little different. We may not see the effective POMV rate being that much lower because we won't have those lower years in the average. So right now, that's helping us by keeping the draw lower. In the future, if returns don't catch up from that negative year in 22, we may actually see you know, the real POMV rate come close, or the real rate of draw coming close to that 5%. So slide 7, talking about the earnings reserve account and the sufficient balance of that. That's been the discussion we had in this committee last session, and the Permanent Fund Corporation's board has had quite a bit. So the Permanent Fund Corporation's statutory net income projection, which is the amount that's realized each year and goes into the ERA. So we can't spend all of the money they get that they receive in investments, only the realized income, which we get from selling assets or from getting dividends or interest. The projection is that that would be 6.65% versus that total return of 7.20%. So it's lower than the total return will be realized and put into the ERA each year. And when you compare that to the inflation of 2.5%, statutory inflation proofing formula is based on that 2.5% inflation times the balance of the principal, and then a 5% POMV draw, you can see that math doesn't add up, even though, again, you know, there's the rising balance, so we're not fully drawing 5%. You still get a mismatch where we're projecting, or the Permanent Fund Corporation is projecting, that even with their forecasted returns, we would see a decline in the balance of the earnings reserve. This graph here comes from the Permanent Fund Corporation's projections. So the blue bar on the bottom is the next year's POMV draw. So they like to reserve that to make sure they have enough money to pay the following year's POMV draw. And then the red on the top is the rest of the realized ERA balance. That's the spendable portion of the earnings reserve account. So you add those together to get the full value of the ERA, but it gives you an idea of how much cushion do we have. And in FY22, those were nearly $14 billion, with high inflation in FY23 and low statutory net income. That dropped to just over $8 billion. By FY33, with that continued decline, essentially there would only be the following year's POMV value left under the forecast. So I think their calculation is $4 million above next year's POMV left in the ERA by FY33 if we continue to inflation-proof each year. I would note that this year, FY24, the legislature capped the inflation-proofing transfer at the 2.5% inflation level. The actual inflation for the U.S. CPI was significantly higher than that. I think it was about 3.5%. So capping it saved, I think it was about $1 billion in the ERA that would have gone out in that inflation-proofing transfer if we had just left it to the formula. So this picture would look a lot worse without that action taken by the legislature. Our probabilistic modeling that we've done on this shows that we have a 54% chance of having an insufficient ERA balance to make the full POMV draw over the forecast period if we inflation-proof each year. So greater than 50% chance now, even though it's, you know, the straight line projection shows that we would just barely make it, or that we'd have, you know, the extra amount in there every year. Our modeling shows that because that volatility, there's a 54% chance that we would not have enough money to make the full POMV draw in the ERA. If we decided we're going to stop inflation proofing when the balance gets to that, what's in that blue bar, the following year POMV, as just a conservative measure to make sure we can make that payment, then that likelihood would drop to 39%. But that, there's nothing in the statute saying we would do that. That's just us potentially saying a course of action that the legislature could take to deal with that. Those are still very high percentages, and it's a very big risk going forward that we won't have enough money in the ERA to make that full POMV draw. So all it is are largest source of revenue and a very stable source of revenue, there's this risk to it that I don't think the straight line projections necessarily show. And so the natural question is, why is this happening? Why don't we have more realized income? Well, a lot of it is due to the nature of the Permanent Fund Corporation's portfolio. So they do have $11.9 billion of unrealized gains as of the end of fiscal year 23, but 70% of that, $8.3 billion, are in relatively illiquid assets like private equity, private income, real estate, where the Permanent Fund can't just go out and say, well, we're going to sell our mall in Virginia and, you know, realize $1 billion of income. We probably wouldn't get that amount of money if we did a fire sale on a large investment property like that, or in private equity where it's an external manager who decides to exit a company. If we decide to pull our money sooner to realize income, it might not necessarily be there. Those values may, for private equity, may actually even be a little inflated still, because the private equity doesn't necessarily, when there's a down market, doesn't necessarily go out for another funding round where they would reduce their valuation. They tend to go out for funding rounds when the markets are going up and when they can increase the valuation. So you don't necessarily see those private equity unrealized gains shrink as much in a down market as the public markets would. And so it may be exaggerating the amount of unrealized gains we have, although last year equalized it a little bit. There's still perhaps a bit of a disconnect where really the true value of those unrealized gains may be lower than what is on our balance sheet just because of the kind of the illiquid nature of those private markets. So I know that was a lot of technical detail, so I can slow down if there's any questions before we move on.
Just want to make a couple of points. Last year we were looking at the cash flow for the state dealing with the permanent fund and our normal oil and gas revenue stream. We'll continue to do that this year. And we took measures in last year's budget, as you referenced, to cap the inflation proofing. We'll have the the permanent fund come in and talk about the historical inflation proofing numbers since inception with other appropriations to see where we are over time. I think we're going to be fairly close to what we should be. We also recognize that there's kind of a disconnect between what's going on in the legislative arena or the state's arena needing revenue from the permanent fund compared to the permanent fund's asset allocation, and their structure is not really doesn't take into account the cash needs of the state. They're supposed to look at just the portfolio itself. So we'll talk about that disconnect. We also have the ability to adjust our inflation contributions going forward if in the event that we think we're going to have tight budgets trying to deal with our dividend and the appropriation to take care of our agencies. So we have that tool. Also, we need to remember that we try to forward fund the draw on the permanent fund also. So there's some flexibility there also. So we have several tools in our toolbox to respond to a potential FY33 bar here that's unacceptable. Right? The whole idea here is to try to see where we're going and then modify the course so we don't hit the rocks. So we've got some tools, and we'll go through those in detail with the permanent fund in future meetings, and then the committee will decide what we want to do with inflation proofing at the end of the session, towards the end of the session, and when we want to pull that trigger. Do we want to have that inflation proofing in the final budget, or do we want to do the inflation proofing next winter? Or how do we want to handle that? So there's a timing issue, too, that is a lever we have to work these situations. So it's not a linear line to a cliff that's going to sink us. We can avoid that. If we do our job, anyway, we can avoid it.
Mr. Chairman, I would just comment that I think raising this issue now is not to be doom and gloom. I think the legislature has shown that, you know, when you see this information last year, the legislature did take action to try to address it. So, you know, raising the issue is you as policymakers can then deal with it. And I think sometimes people say, oh, it's just risk, you know, doom and gloom for much finance. But by raising these issues, you know, the committee has the ability to react before it becomes a crisis. So I think, you know, the committee's action last year demonstrated that. And the other body, I think, didn't even put inflation proofing in at all. So both bodies last year recognized the risk.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Senator Stebbins, for always like to let you go first. And then case I have the same question, don't want to answer it twice, but I want to talk just a second about the lost opportunity cost of not fully inflation proofing, and just put that on the record as another data point.
I think just a note on that, just so the public doesn't misinterpret what we're saying, we don't want the erosion of purchasing power over time. If, just like in the past, when we've skipped inflation proofing, we recognize that and we try to catch up on it in better times. And that also revolves around the draw rate and the projections of the return and the asset allocation. So we'll have all those discussions coming up in more detail. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you get us the information on what other large funds do regarding inflation? Do they inflation at all? The large funds, such as the permanent fund. That would be very interesting to look at.
Co-Chair Hoffman, yes, we can get you that information. I would say that generally it's unusual to have a separation of the principal of the endowment and then an income account. That's a structure that was common when the permanent fund was created in the 70s and is very uncommon now. In fact, in the state, we collapsed one of our endowments. The Public School Trust Fund used to be in that structure, and we collapsed it in 2018 because we had the ability to do that through statute. So I think it's relatively unusual to have this structure where that would even be a question. But yeah, we can see if there's other endowments that have that model.
And I bring this up because people have investments all over the world, and individuals have investments. And, my investments, I don't inflation proof them. I depend upon the markets to get my realized, my margins of income. So it's something that I would like to see at least at the national level regarding large funds.
Okay. Any other questions on the slide? Okay. Slide number 8.
All right. Going on to the fall 2023 revenue forecast. So this revenue forecast is an interesting one because I think you heard from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources that we're kind of moving into this new era for the North Slope in terms of the oil revenue and where it's coming from. So I'm going to go through that in a bit of detail. I'll try to keep it out of the weeds too much, but we'll see how well I'm able to do that. So the fall revenue forecast shows higher oil prices than the previous forecast for both FY24 and FY25, but it shows lower oil production, higher lease expenditures. Those are the costs that the producers incur, and then higher transportation costs. So the result is that revenue is up over the spring forecast, but by significantly less than price alone would explain. So if you look at this top right graph, you can see that in FY24, revenue is up by $221 million. In FY25, it's up by $79 million. However, the price is up in FY24 by $9.39 and $6 in FY25. Last year, we said that each marginal dollar of additional oil price would get you about $70 million a barrel. I think Department of Revenue said that's down to million dollars per dollar of oil prices. So, $6 a barrel, you would think would take us up more than $79 million, but those other factors counteract that to make it so the total revenue increase is less than that. Production is down in both 24 and 25, and we'll get into some of the kind of field by field numbers on the following slide. And then lease expenditures are up significantly. In FY24, they're up $755 million over the lease expenditures in the spring forecast. In FY25, they're up $1.6 billion over the previous forecast. So those are generally deductions against the production tax and reduce our production tax liability. A lot of that is due to the increased certainty of the Willow and Pickup projects as they're moving forward. And we'll talk more about those. But the big picture is that while prices are up, there's a significant shift going on underneath the surface in the revenue forecast that makes it so we get less than you would expect for that price. So going on to slide 9, this is a comparison of production from one forecast to another. So On the right, you see the fall 2022 forecast. We have more information in the fall forecast. So sometimes we're going to be comparing to the spring forecast, sometimes to the fall. For the production forecast, they're fairly similar, but we just get more information from the Department of Revenue then. So in this case, we're doing a fall to fall comparison. In the fall 2022 forecast, you can see that production was relatively flat. There was a bit of a peak in 27-28, and then this curve. Fall 2023 is lower production in the near term and higher production in the later term than the previous forecast. If you look at lease expenditures, you can see that the fall forecast is higher in every year, particularly in FY27 through 29, when those would be those peak investments in the Willow Field. Since lease expenditures are deductible from the production tax, those higher lease expenditures generally mean less revenue to the state. They will often bring a company down to the gross tax floor of 4% rather than paying based on their profits. New production is also eligible for what's called the gross value reduction, or GVR, that reduces production tax in the initial years of production. So as you see more new production coming in, that doesn't necessarily mean you get a lot of additional revenue right away, because it's going to be eligible for a gross value reduction, and there may be carried forward losses or other deductions from the previous years. So while this new production is promising for the long term, in the short term, it means less revenue and won't be as much new revenue as you would expect if you just did linear. Oh, we're up 100,000 barrels, production revenue would go up by 20%. It's not quite linear, because that's new production that's not worth as much in our production tax calculation.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Thanks for being here, Mr. Painter. Does legislative finance concur with Department of Revenue's estimate that a dollar change in oil price equates to $45
million? Through the Chair, Senator Merrick, based on their production, yes. Their forecast, yes. I think they've changed how they treat volatility a little bit to starting, I think, a year ago, in a way that we think is probably more accurate. So that number, I think, is better than it used to be in terms of accuracy. They were putting in additional costs based on increasing price of oil in the short term. That was, I think, probably more additional costs than was reasonable to assume. They've reduced that estimate to something based on actual data that I think is a more reasonable number. So I think we're in agreement with them at this point.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So this is a busy slide, but I think the points are important. So this is a table comparing the production by unit in the fall 2022 forecast to the fall 2023 forecast. And highlighted in red are those fields with a significant reduction in production. And then in green are the ones with a significant increase. So Prudhoe Bay is our largest legacy field. The new forecast shows a significant reduction in Prudhoe Bay revenue pretty much across the board. Prudhoe Bay production pretty much across the board. Because that's the legacy field that has the lowest cost, that does have a kind of an outsized impact on our revenue. But there's an increase in those Prudhoe Bay satellites, those newer fields listed on the bottom here. So those are going to make up for that production difference. But again, some of those may be new fields rather than just infill. They may then not bring in quite as much revenue immediately. Kuparuk, another of our legacy fields, has lower production year by year. But again, the Kuparuk satellites, those newer fields, have higher production throughout the forecast. Another really interesting story is the NPRA. So right now, that is the Greater Moose's Tooth unit. There's a new well there that has not come online as fast and produced as much as I think was initially expected. So there's, in the short term, a big reduction in production from the National Petroleum Reserve. And then the long term, as the Willow project is increasingly certain from the previous forecast, there's a big increase in production. So that, again, if you're looking at that bottom line number where the total production in FY25 is down by 39.5 thousand barrels a day. The biggest impact of that is actually in the NPRA, where, as the committee discussed last week with the Department of Natural Resources and Revenue, that we don't get royalties from that because it's on federal land, or the state does not. And so there's less of a revenue impact. So there's really a mixed picture here in terms of what's going on underneath the surface. These are pretty big changes, but they're, I don't think, necessarily in a consistent direction. So again, this is kind of masked by price if you look at the total forecast, but we do see the general theme is lower production in those legacy fields, higher production in newer fields, particularly in the out years in Willow coming online.
If we could on the production, when you guys have time, it'd be nice to put it in per barrels, historic barrels of production, and then forecasted barrels production. It's nice to do the comparison like you did with one forecast versus the other forecast, but it would give the committee, I think, another way of looking at it for magnitude. Clearly, Prudhoe is colossal in size to other things. We put it in per barrels, we can watch that. And then it would also help, I think, when we have other testifiers in here over time that may be working in one particular field or something, we'd have the data right at hand to ask them about productions on whatever fields they're managing.
Chair Sedman, yes, we can provide that. So this next slide compares the last three fall revenue forecasts. So the fall 2021, 22, and 23 forecasts over the forecast window. We're using the forecast window from the first one because they don't all go out to FY33. And what's interesting here in on the left, there's a pretty big difference in oil prices in the short term between the various forecasts. That shrinks over time as the markets have sort of converged, on what the long-term view of oil is, somewhere in the $70 to $80 range or upper 60s in some of these forecasts. In terms of revenue, we actually have an even tighter band than price because some of these changes we've been seeing, the increased, while prices have increased, costs have increased as well by more than expected because of those new fields. And so there's actually a very small band in revenue differences in the out years. And I'm highlighting that in part to just show that while it looks like when we look at that oil price graph that there's a ton of volatility in our revenue, if you look at the long-term forecast, there's actually been relatively little difference. I think the difference between the highest and lowest years in FY27 or 28 is like $500 million, which that's a lot in our budgeting terms, but for 5 or 10 years out is actually a pretty narrow band. So for fiscal planning purposes long-term, we actually haven't been seeing a whole lot of volatility in our long-term outlook despite those short-term variations. So, there is an ability to try to craft a long-term fiscal plan around those ranges of likely revenue because it really hasn't shifted the last few years. The bigger picture has been remarkably similar for several years. Okay, so there's key takeaways on revenue. The increased certainty of that Willow project is evident in the forecast, so the increased lease expenditures and increased future production. The revenue impact to the state is negative while the project is under development. It will become positive after it enters production. Last year, the committee heard from the Department of Revenue with their analysis of the project. It sounds like they have a new version in the works that may be interesting to hear how that major project will impact our revenue over the forecast period. The new forecast anticipates lower production in some legacy units as well as greater Moose's Tooth and then higher production from the satellites. And then despite the significant shifts in the fundamentals behind the petroleum revenue forecast, the overall anticipated revenue in the medium to long term has not really changed for the last few years because those increases in price have sort of masked those underlying shifts that are happening. All right, turning to the budget side on slide 13. So in fiscal year 24, the enacted budget that we passed last year had an estimated $293 million surplus based on the spring revenue forecast after vetoes. There was a provision that split the first $636 million of general fund revenue received above the spring forecast. So at the time, we had a dollar amount for the spring forecast that equated to $73 a barrel. So any revenue above that, the first $636 million, would be split between an energy relief payment that would be paid out next fiscal year because it can't be calculated until the end of this fiscal year, and then the constitutional budget reserve. Any additional revenue beyond that $636 million, if we got to that place, was appropriated directly to the constitutional budget reserve. At the time, the spring forecast had $73 a barrel of oil, but we didn't peg it to that oil price. The legislature pegged it to the total revenue. With that shift we saw in increased costs, that trigger point for when we get the amount of revenue that equals the spring forecast moved from $73 a barrel to $78 a barrel. And it used to be that we would max out that $636 million at $83 a barrel at the spring forecast. Now we max that out at $90 a barrel. So instead of being sliding from 73 to 83, it's now sliding from 78 to 90 because of those higher costs that we're seeing in fiscal year 24 and lower production. So based on the fall revenue forecast, that's $82 oil roughly in the production levels, $110.6 million would go into each of the CBR and energy relief payment in FY24. We would estimate that's about $175 a person that would go out with the FY25 permanent fund dividend. But that surplus, based on the fall forecast, doesn't really change. It's still $293 million because any revenue change is just basically handled by that appropriation. So we still have a surplus before any supplementals of $293 million. That's available for appropriation this session. If we don't appropriate it, it would lapse to the constitutional budget reserve at the end of the fiscal year.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, can you remind the committee of how much the governor vetoed in the FY24 budget?
Chair Hoffman, I'd have to get back to you with that number. It was over $100 million, I think it was around $200 million, but I can get you an exact number in response to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for a point of clarity, on your third bullet, it's 110.6, but just round it off to 110 million each to go to the added dividend and then the CBR. But that year is still open for appropriation. If we chose to appropriate that 220 million, in a supplemental budget, what impact would that have on that $175 per person dividend addition?
Mr. Chairman, if we modified those appropriations, we could change those trigger points or get rid of them. We do have that $293 million that we can spend before getting into having to modify those. So if we keep supplementals to $293 million or less, we would not have to change those appropriations. We could choose to, but we could change those trigger points, or, you know, instead of $78 a barrel, we can move it up to 80 something dollars a barrel or move it down, or it's still live in the supplemental. So yeah, we could shift that in any way that the legislature wants to in the budget this year.
Let me try to rephrase the question. What if we didn't address that? We just spent the money. We spent the $220 million. Appropriated to XYZ agency or whatever. What impact does that have, if any, on this, on the dividend portion of this?
Mr. Chairman, we would have a bit of a conflict of our appropriations because we've already appropriated that money to the constitutional budget reserve and the energy relief. If we didn't modify those appropriations and just appropriated that money again, we would then just have a deficit that would have to come from somewhere. We didn't get a constitutional budget reserve vote in fiscal year 24, and there's only $20 million in the statutory budget reserve. So if we spent more, we would have an unfilled deficit, essentially.
And the reason I bring it up before we go to Senator Hoffman's question is when we have the supplementals in front of us, we need to take into account we have this mechanism sitting here. So it would be a little more complex than normal. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That brings up the supplemental for FY24. Whatever that number is, are you saying that the $110 million will still go into the CBR regardless of how large the supplemental is for 24?
Senator Hoffman, Chair Hoffman, as long as we spend $292 million or less in the supplemental of unrestricted general funds, that there would be no impact on the transfer to the Constitutional Budget Reserve or the energy relief. If we spent more than that, it could have an impact because we would have a run into a deficit again. But as long as we keep the supplementals to that amount under the spring forecast, then there should be no impact on those other appropriations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This next slide shows a graphic version of what I just talked about. I probably should switch to this earlier because it's probably easier to understand than all the words. The one, I'll just orient to the graph and then move on. But the blue revenue in the bottom here is the UGF revenue that would go to meet the budget. If prices are below $71 a barrel, again, we don't have a deficit filling mechanism other than the $20 million statutory budget reserve, so we'd have an unfilled deficit. So if prices really go down the tubes the next few months, we'd potentially need to get a constitutional budget reserve vote to fill the deficit. That's what we did last year. We had enough surplus to deal with up to a certain point, and then once we hit that, prices were too low, and so we had to get a constitutional budget reserve vote to make sure we could fund the budget. This year, that trigger point was $71 a barrel, and the forecast is $82 a barrel right now. If the revenue comes in at the spring forecast or above, we'd have $292 million as a surplus. Then beyond that, the money would be split. So you see the orange is the energy relief. The green is that amount to the CBR. So the spendable surplus is that yellow bar. That doesn't change as price goes up. Once it hits that $292 million, it doesn't change because last year's budget appropriated everything else beyond that to either the Constitutional Budget Reserve or the energy relief payment. To access this money, if we get prices that high, we would have to modify those appropriations. But otherwise, we have kind of a fixed amount for supplementals that's the surplus below that.
So to your earlier point here at the break even before we go into the red zone at $71, we'd need a three-quarter vote to balance it. That three-quarter vote would most, in the normal process, would be budget process would be in May. The end of the fiscal year is in June. What if you don't have the votes?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't run into that scenario in a long time, but potentially at that point you get into, if the legislature is in session, we can deal with it through negative supplementals, reducing appropriations, or shifting appropriations. If the legislature doesn't deal with it and gavels out with an unfilled deficit in FY24, the governor would have to try to take action, either call us back in a special session, or if we still don't want to do anything, he could restrict expenditures on existing appropriations as needed to balance the budget. Given the price is $71 a barrel that would occur, it would take a pretty big swing in prices to make that happen. And I would assume the legislature would act if that did happen, but if worse comes to worse and we refuse to act, then it would be up to the governor to try to make it through the year.
Okay.
So slide 15, the governor's initial budget release included some supplemental requests. We will get more next week on the 15th legislative day. So he has $17 million of unrestricted general fund supplementals and some federal funds. And Director Sanders went over these last week, or 2 days ago. It wasn't last week. It was a lot more recent. So I'm not going to cover them again, other than to mention that the governor's fiscal summary has a placeholder for $61 million for fire suppression based on a preliminary number from the Department of Natural Resources. My initial read is that we may not need that full amount, depending on how much federal money we get back. But their estimate was from, I think, the end of August, so it's quite dated at this point. I think they're working on a newer estimate. We'll see what fire suppression number we need. We also would anticipate supplementals in the Departments of Corrections and the Department of Health for Medicaid based on their December projection that showed that we were a little bit short. There may be others, but those are the two that I would see as the most likely. So there may be additional supplementals you'll see next week that will eat into that $292 million surplus. Right now, the governor just has $17 million that eat into that surplus.
Okay, next slide, please.
All right, so getting into the building the FY25 budget. So going to go through this in a little more depth than in the past, how we build the budget, because we made a little bit of a change in how we do the adjusted base this year. So the starting point for the next year's budget is what we call the adjusted base. That's the prior year's budget less one-time appropriations. So if we say in the budget that something's a one-time appropriation, that comes out before in the adjusted base. And then statewide current policy decisions like salary adjustments, those can't really be dealt with at the subcommittee level. They're an all or nothing thing. So we put them in the adjusted base so that they can be dealt with on a statewide level. And the new thing this year is it also includes formula changes that are based on paying the same formula as last year, but the formula number changes. So I'll give you an example of what that would be. So in the past, we would say the adjusted base for statewide items is basically just last year's budget. But we know that from year to year, our debt service number changes from year based on the debt schedule. So this year, we handle that in adjusted base. We say that if we fully funded debt last year, then the adjusted base is fully funding this year's debt number, because that's kind of an external change. It's not a policy shift by the governor. The purpose of the adjusted base is to kind of have a clean starting point where the governor's policy changes are highlighted as a change from adjusted base. And if we're just fully funding debt service again, that's not a shift in policy. That's doing the same policy as last year. The same would be true for the K-12 formula. There's a formula in statute based on what we have passed in law. The shift from last year's student count to this year's projected student count is not a policy change by the governor. He is still fully funding the formula. That is handled in adjusted base now. So then you can clearly see the policy changes by the governor. Does the governor propose additional funding beyond the formula, or is he proposing funding below the formula as he did in his first year? That would be a change from adjusted base. You could clearly see that formula change from adjusted base, rather than having to say, well, what would the formula be this year, and then what does the governor have? And a little harder to find. So the goal is to make it easier to identify those policy changes by the governor by building in more of these formula items into the adjusted base. It's a little bit more work with the Office of Management and Budget to make sure we coordinate. But I think it provides a cleaner starting point. In previous years, I came before this committee and talked about we have adjusted base, but then we have a current policy baseline and a current law baseline. And I think people were lost in three different baselines. This will simplify that a bit, because now what we had called the current policy baseline is the adjusted base. So they're now the same thing. The current policy we did last year is now the adjusted base going forward. That includes things like the permanent fund dividend that we funded at a partial amount. So last year we funded it at 25% of the percent of market value. So the adjusted base this year would be 25% of the new percent of market value draw. So the new PMV draw, 25% of that. So it aligns with that current policy baseline. Not necessarily the same number from year to year, but the same policy going forward. With that change, also the Office of Management and Budget is agreed to start using the adjusted base in their comparisons, because, again, it helps them distinguish governor's policy items from non-policy changes and should make comparisons a little easier. So I think it's a positive change. It's a little bit to understand, working your head around, but I think it reducing the number of times we have to say baseline referring to different things should reduce confusion once people are used to this. I know that was a complaint of some people last year. So I'm going to walk through in the adjusted base the various changes that are made, because I think understanding that before we get to the governor's budget helps set the table for then what are the policy changes the governor has. So the first thing we do is remove one-time items from last year. We had $165.3 million of UGF one-time items. Over half of that was the K-12 outside the formula funding after the veto. That was $87.4 million. Since that was designated as a one-time item, that comes out in adjusted base. The others are a mix of items that, you know, the legislature put in as one-time items or that were governor's items that we turned into one-time items, like those education items. He put in a number of programs that he wanted to be permanent, like the Alyeska Reading Academy. And the legislature said, well, we'd rather make sure we look at those again next year. So we made them one-time items. So all of those are backed out in the adjusted base. Another significant one would be the Alaska Marine Highway System backstop funds. We had had a provision last year that said if there was insufficient federal revenue, we'd have up to $10 million after veto of general funds going into that program. That was a one-time item. That comes out of the adjusted base this year, and the governor didn't put it back forward. So if you see that the first thing is we remove $165 million, that makes the comparison of the governor's new policy initiatives, I think, a little easier to see after we've removed all of those. Then the next series of changes are those formula adjustments. And I mentioned these are new to put in the adjusted base. The largest negative one is the K-12 formula. The new student count has a reduced state share, but that the reasons for it is really not driven by the student count. It's driven by who is paying for that formula. So the reductions are $12.2 million due to increased required local effort. That's due to property tax values in municipalities increasing. So the share that the municipalities are required to pay has increased because that's based on, for most districts, a mill rate on their property value. So as that goes up, their costs go up, our cost goes down. There's also an increase in the amount of federal deductible impact aid. We're allowed to deduct up to 90% of eligible impact aid from what the state pays. That amount of federal impact aid that's scheduled to go out in FY25 increased by $15.8 million. That's a reduction of what we pay. It's not a reduction of what's going out to the districts. It's just a reduction in our costs. The student count changes actually is only a $2.2 million reduction. So there is a projected decrease in student count. It's partially offset by higher numbers of special need intensive students and higher number of correspondence students. And so you see that the student count only decreases it by $2.2 million. There's also an increase in the formula amount due to a provision in the Alaska Reads Act that provides $3 million more of pre-K funding in the formula each year than the previous year. So started with zero and then went to $3 million, up to $3 million based on districts applying, then $3 million more on top of that each year. So that's a $3 million increase. That all nets to that $27 million reduction of all funds going out of state money to the K-12 formula. There's an increase in the pupil or the public school trust fund amount. So the general fund amount goes down by $30 million. But again, that doesn't really decrease the money going to districts. It's a shift of who is paying, more by the federal government, more by the local governments, less by our general funds. Pupil transportation, because that brick and mortar student count is down, is projected to decrease by about $2 million. School debt reimbursement is projected to go down by about $9.2 million of general fund, UGF, and then some school funds as well. That's tobacco tax revenue. The moratorium on new school debt has been going since since 2015, is scheduled to end July 1st of next year, 2025. Because of that moratorium, the amount of outstanding school debt goes down each year, and so our share of the reimbursement has just gone down each year. Significant reduction this year, several larger projects have gone off the list. Then starting in July of 2025, districts are able to start bonding again and add new debt. So we may see that formula turn around once they're able to do that next year. Other debt service is up slightly in other funds, but down in unrestricted general funds. That's our general obligation bond or airport debt. The increase, I think, is in the airport side. State contributions to retirement are up nearly $46 million in general funds. The state share of that, this is just the share that we pay on behalf of other employers. There's an additional amount we'll see in a subsequent slide that is the state as an employer. So this is just the cost increase for us paying on behalf of local government and governments and school districts that are capped at their amount. That went up due to a lower or a higher unfunded liability amount in the ARM board. And I don't know if we want to talk more about that. I don't have any more slides about retirement, but that is one of the big increases this year. And then the REAA fund, the Regional Educational Attendance Area and Small District Fund, capitalization is down slightly. That's a function of school debt going down. Those two programs are tied together. It's based on a previous year's school debt, so there's not a big reduction. But next year, you'll see a bigger reduction in the amount going into that fund because of that large reduction in school debt this year. So a lot of information. I'll pause for questions.
Senator Merg.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Mr. Painter, how can districts start bonding again in 25 if the moratorium is through 26?
Through the Chair, Senator Merrick, it's through FY26, the beginning of FY26. So it's July, the moratorium ends July 1st, 2025. That's the beginning of fiscal year 26. So I guess I should have written that as 16 through 25 because the moratorium ends starting in 26. But depending on when municipal elections are, they could go out that fall of 2025. The state wouldn't incur costs right away because they wouldn't be reimbursing it right away. But we may see some added state costs perhaps as early as FY27 based on districts going back out.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Is there a way to calculate how many years of moratorium we would need to totally exhaust that debt?
Through the Chair, Senator Merrick, yes, I'd have to look at the debt schedule. There's still amounts going all the way through FY33. That's our forecast window, but I know we have a full debt schedule, and I can get that back to the committee with what year that would be completely retired.
I think at some point we'll have them come in with the debt schedule for the entire state, including the schools, so we look at that. That's a good question. Have other questions on this slide?
Okay, moving on to slide 19, still going on the adjusted base. So the first item is, again, related to retirement. The state as an employer pays the new rates each year out of our operating budget. So there's salary adjustments totaling $11 million of unrestricted general funds, $22.7 million of all funds. For those new higher PERS rates, and there's actually lower PERS is the public employee retirement system, JERS is the judicial retirement system, there's actually a lower rate for that system, so the slight reduction in a couple of places for that. But that's an increase that goes along with that $46 million increase that's due to those higher retirement rates this year. There's health insurance increases, and then there's increases for several unions from their past year's contracts, their next year. So far, we have not seen any new agreements. There are three unions that are currently negotiating that we may still see future adjustments. These are just the ones that are from past years that were already authorized. I would note that the legislature has to authorize that funding each year. It doesn't work that we just approve the contract in year one and then it's good every year. Every year that they have an increase, we have to fund it in order for that raise to actually happen. So these out years, these are not the first year of the contract, but we still do have to approve them in order for that contract to take effect. And so there's a total of $44.5 million of unrestricted general fund salary adjustments, $97 million of all funds. The majority of that are these additional amounts of past year salary adjustments. This number will go up as we get those other three unions in. Those will be future governor's amendments. They're due on the 60th legislative day, so we won't necessarily see them at the governor's amended budget on day 30. Those often come in after the deadline for regular amendments because they have a longer deadline for these contracts. So we'll see future increases. And also note that the last time the legislature increased the salaries for exempt employees, there was a provision in that bill that said that future increases to the supervisory union would be given to the exempt employees. That needs an additional statutory change to happen. The supervisory union is one of the ones that's negotiating now. So when we see that agreement, the legislature can choose, do we want to follow that previous intent and apply that to the exempt employees as well? but that would take a substantive bill. That can't happen just through the budget. So that would be an additional action, but we don't even know what that number is yet. So it's hard to figure out at this point what are the total salary adjustments going to be at the end of the year, because there are those three unions and then that policy choice of do you apply that to exempt employees as well.
So yesterday we had a presentation from the OMB director, and she had a slide showing the vacancies across the agencies. And we had asked her, actually asked her after the meeting, as I recall, to let us know what's the physical impact if we went to the more standardized rate of vacancies, letting her pick the standardized rate if it's 10% or 5% or what was the historical comfort level, to see what that impact would be on our budget, because there is a difference between the authorized positions and the funded positions. But what if we went up to the 5% vacancy or 8% vacancy? What would that financial impact be? So maybe you can help I'll work with OMB, however you guys do it, so the finance committee can get a good feel for what that actually would look like. I think it would make a significant change in our overall budget numbers, is what I'm expecting.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we'll work with them on that. And then tomorrow, if there's time, I'll have a few more slides on that vacancy amount, trying to provide a little more information about it. Okay, so finally, we're done with the adjusted base. We can talk about the governor's budget. So this is the UGF comparison of the governor's budget from FY24 and 25. So the revenue forecast overall is a reduction due to the lower price of $177 million. Agency operations, you can see that the governor's budget is $100 million below FY24. But as we saw a few slides ago, there were $165 million of one-time items. So a lot of that reduction is really just that he's not repeating those one-time items. He doesn't have money outside the formula for K-12, for example. If you compare his budget to adjusted base, it's actually a couple percent above the adjusted base. Statewide items are up $18.2 million. The capital budget is down $54.6 million. The largest increase in the governor's budget is going from the 25% of POMV dividend last year to the statutory dividend estimated to be $2.3 billion. And then that energy relief payment is not repeated, so that's a reduction. Overall, before considering supplementals, the governor's budget is up $1.175 billion, or 19.2%. Again, that's largely due to that increase in the permanent fund dividend level. So in FY24, before transfers, including that $110 million estimated to the CBR we've discussed, we would have a $416.6 million surplus. After transfers, we have the $292.7 million we've talked about a couple of times. That's our surplus in FY24 available for appropriation. So far, the governor spent $17 million of that, leaving us with $275.7 million of surplus in FY24. Then in FY25, our post-transfer surplus deficit is $982.3 million based on the governor's budget. So nearly $1 billion budget. He proposes to meet that by transferring from the CBR and SBR. I would note that there's a few numbers here that are a little different than OMB's fiscal summary. Part of that is that they're not incorporating those estimates for the energy relief and constitutional budget reserve in their estimates yet, since those are fluid numbers. We're putting them in there to make it clear how much you have available for appropriation, but they're leaving those as kind of floating estimates. And then we assume that any unspent surplus goes to the CBR, so our CBR numbers here are higher than theirs, because we assume we have a $275 million surplus. If we do nothing, that goes to the CBR. So we'd end up with $3.2 billion in the CBR, assuming we don't spend that. If we spent some of that surplus, that number would go down. That FY25 number is after drawing from the CBR. So we're showing higher CBR balances, again, because we're showing that surplus, if nothing else happens, would go there, whereas they were assuming that probably gets spent. But again, it hasn't yet, so we're not showing it spent quite yet. Okay, so the big picture is the pre-transfers fiscal deficit of $977 million. That's the true fiscal deficit. The post-transfer is sort of after we've moved money around. Not a big difference this year, but usually we like to use that pre-transfer number to represent the true fiscal health of the state. The largest increase is that statutory PFD. The non-PFD appropriations are up from the adjusted base, but there's quite a few items that we'll talk about in a subsequent slide where we would expect that the final number will be higher than the governor's budget, and we'll talk about those reasons a bit later. So slide 22 is something that the chairman requested of the Office of Management and Budget. Is a swoop graph, as we call it, that compare that includes the permanent fund dividend and the capital budget. So the red bars are the FY24 management plan numbers. The blue bars are the FY25 governor's proposals. We sorted them by the largest expenditure in FY25 to the smallest. So you can see the largest item in the governor's budget this year is the permanent fund dividend, followed by the Department of Education and the Department of Health. Last year, the permanent fund dividend was the third largest item after education and health. And then there's significant increases in a few agencies, Department of Corrections, Family and Community Services, Public Safety, and then significant decreases in education, health, and the capital budget, among others. Okay, so Director Sanders went through the highlights in the agency operations in much greater depth than I will. I'm just going to highlight a few things for your awareness. So the agency operations are $94.9 million above the adjusted base. So we said they were below last year, but then they're above adjusted base. And that's because of the one-time items being removed. So $20.8 million, there's a $20.8 million UGF reduction in the governor's budget due to the sunset of the senior benefits program. He removed that funding. It will be put back in a fiscal note if it extends. That's the technically proper way to handle it with a sunsetting program. You remove it, remove the funding, and then we can add it back in a fiscal note. Governor Walker faced a similar scenario, put the funding in, and the legislature removed it to make it a fiscal note. So this year the governor did what the legislature did before. Doesn't really matter, but I think the point is when you're figuring out where our budget's going to end up, if you assume that program's going to be extended, you should probably add that back in. There's a significant increase to the Department of Corrections that Director Sanders went over. She talked about the increments. There's also fund changes because of use of the what used to be PFD criminal. Is it recidivism reduction? There's too many of these. No, that's the other one. Gonna bungle that one, sorry. But the what used to be called PFD criminal funds going down due to the lower dividend in FY24 versus FY23. In the Department of Education, there were a number of items that the legislature made one-time items last year that were backed out. Then the governor is asking for them to become permanent items, such as the Alyeska Reading Academy, $5 million. So those are not new, but they're increments over the adjusted base because you had made them one-time items last year. There's a reduction in the Department of Health of $6.2 million to stop funding what was a multi-year or a temporary increment for the tuberculosis and congenital syphilis elimination plans. Last year, we funded those as FY24 through 30 temporary increments. The governor backed that funding out and did not put it back. So that's a reduction that you see in his budget. There's various increases in the Department of Transportation. That's the other kind of big increase. A lot of that is due to the expiration of federal COVID funds. There's also reduced federal support for the Whittier Tunnel that's being replaced by general funds, and then increases for commodities and snow removal. So quite a bit of a UGF increase in that department as well. So statewide items, the governor's fully funding school debt reimbursement, the regional education attendance area fund capitalization, state assistance to retirement. They're all funded at the statutory level, and so it matches the adjusted base. He's making the statutory appropriation to community assistance. Because that funding was vetoed last year, that's not in the adjusted base because the current policy last year after the veto was not to fund it, so it shows up as an increase. I would note that because of the veto, the distribution to communities is one-third of the balance as of the end of the fiscal year. So in FY25, with no supplemental, $20 million would go out to communities. That would be enough to basically pay the base payments, but no per capita payments. There would have to be a supplemental appropriation to get back to $30 million. And then if that continued, putting in $30 million this year would result in still a reduced amount going out to communities in FY26 and beyond, unless we ever made a catch-up appropriation. He has funding for additional fund capitalizations, the Disaster Relief Fund. We had put $50 million into that in FY22 as a supplemental appropriation, so we hadn't funded it in FY23 or 24. The governor's putting in $5 million again, which is sort of our kind of placeholder for the year-to-year cost. There is still money left in there, but he wants to keep building it up. He has appropriations into the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project Fund, aka LNG Fund, and then into the Clean Water and Drinking Water Funds that support Department of Environmental Conservation programs. That $3.4 million we actually put in the budget 2 years ago and was not spent at that point because the department wasn't ready to do those additional projects. They're now ready, so they're asking for it again. Those funds we gave 2 years ago just lapsed to the general fund at the time. So it's when I saw this, I was like, I thought we already did that. But apparently they weren't able to get it out the door 2 years ago. So bringing that back forward this year. Capital budget, $305 million UGF, $3.5 billion of all funds, so primarily federal funds. About half of the unrestricted general funds this year in the governor's capital budget are for matching federal funds. The largest new item is $1 billion for the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, or BEAD program. That's their full 5 years of funding. We don't have to provide all 5 years. They're asking for it now. There's no match associated with that funding. There's $25 million of UGF for a new AHFC down payment assistance program, and $22.8 million to Department of Public Safety for several projects that Director Sanders spoke about, so I won't go over those. Somehow my bullets got changed to an interesting symbol here. That's a new. $18.2 million for several university projects, including the UGF for UAF to achieve research tier one status. We'll talk tomorrow in the presentation about whether that's appropriate for the capital budget. I think several of these new items are probably more appropriate for the operating budget. There's $5 million for the year three of the drone program. The governor is putting in funding for the school major maintenance grants and school construction grants. That's enough for the top project on the school major maintenance, or I think the top project on school construction, top two projects on school major maintenance. And then there's also funding for a fish and game research vessel for the Gulf and Bering Sea. Going on to slide 26, this is probably the more interesting part, what's not yet in the budget. So the governor's budget is at this point, definitely a starting point. There's amendments coming out on day 30, supplementals next week. And so when you're thinking about where are we likely to end up at the end of the year, I think it's important to highlight what's not funded yet. So for education, there's no outside the formula funds. There's no BSA increase, base student allocation increase. Last year, there was $87.4 million outside the formula after veto that went out. The education bill that's pending in the other body right now, I think, is up to a cost of about $220 million of unrestricted general funds. So to give you a scale of where we may end up, it's probably unlikely that we will end up with no additional funds to education. Where we'll end up is a policy question for you all. But it's worth noting that that's not yet accounted for in the governor's budget. There's a pending issue with the federal disparity test. If that goes against the state, we could end up having state costs increasing by $89.1 million if we are not able to deduct federal impact aid if we fail the disparities test federally. We don't know how that's going to land, but I think it's a significant concern that we may want to factor into our budgeting to make sure that if we do fail, we don't end up with an unfunded deficit, because it's a significant risk at this point. Medicaid, the governor's budget does not include an increase to Medicaid funding. The Department of Health did a projection that was released right before the governor's budget was prepared or released, so it wasn't built into the governor's budget. They estimate that they will need an additional $22.6 million of general funds. They will update that projection for the governor's amended budget, and we'll see if that new number is factored in. There's a really high error bar right now on that Medicaid number as they go through their redetermination process. It's very difficult to tell exactly how many people will be enrolled in Medicaid a year from now as they go through that. So there really is a pretty high uncertainty on that, but based on their projection as of December, I think it was December 11th, they did that projection, they would need another $22.6 million of UGF. Senior benefits program I mentioned earlier, if that program is reauthorized, that would increase the budget by $20.8 million. The Alaska Energy Authority received a grant, an electrical grid grant, of $206.5 million that needs a 50-50 match, so we would owe $206.5 million as well to upgrade the Alaska Rail Belt energy grid. The funds may be spread over several years for the match, although I think they need their federal money up front, but there will need to be significant investment of general funds up front. It's possible that there could be bonding for that. There's an existing HFC bond that could potentially be partially repurposed to pay for this, but that would require approval of the bondholders, so that is no guarantee. Even if it's funded over several years, when we talked to the Alaska Energy Authority, they said that most likely this legislative session they would need $30 to $35 million. They're still working on various financing plans. Even if they were able to repurpose their bond this year, they would probably need backstop in case their bondholders don't go along with that plan. So I think it would be prudent to plan on at least $30 to $35 million. I think that number will be firmed up in the governor's amendment process. That was just a preliminary number they threw out there when we talked to them last month. Again, when you're trying to figure out where we might end up this session, it's probably a good idea to budget something for that program, assuming the state wants to match that. And the Alaska Marine Highway budget. So the governor's calendar, that budget is on a calendar year, not a fiscal year, but we fund it using fiscal year money essentially. So the calendar year 25 budget is the same level basically as the calendar year 24 budget. In calendar year 24, we budgeted for we applied for $66 million of federal funds. We were budgeted $76 million of federal funds, but there was a backstop of $10 million. So even though we didn't think we could apply even for that full amount, the UGF could cover that additional $10 million in calendar year 24. So they applied for $66 million, but they only received $38 million for the operating budget. So there's a significant shortfall between what the department was eligible for and applied for in calendar year 24 and what they actually received. The difference was that the federal government doesn't have to give out the exact full amount every year. So they gave us a little more in calendar year 23 than the full amount, and then a little less in calendar year 24. We don't know what they'll do for 25. They also gave some of the money to American Samoa, which doesn't actually qualify for the program, but the federal government has the flexibility to shift it to other states and territories that do not meet the requirements at the Secretary of Transportation's discretion. So he chose to give $21 million to American Samoa. So the result of that is that in calendar year 24, we received $38 million less than what we applied for, or $28 million less. Going into calendar year 25, again, it's uncertain. We're still eligible for $66 million. The governor budgeted $76 million of general funds. So there's a $10 million gap. He didn't put in any backstop language. So we know there's a $10 million gap. And then if once again we don't get everything we apply for, that gap could grow. If it's the same, if we get the same amount in calendar year 25 as we got in calendar year 24, we'd have a $38 million gap. On the other hand, not good news, but the Marine Highway has not been able to run their full schedule because of crew issues and vessel issues. So they're budgeted level for calendar year 25 may be beyond what they could perform, even if we did have revenue behind it. So as we go into the Marine Highway budgeting process, I think there's a lot of unknowns. What schedule is reasonable to run? How much federal money might we actually get? There could be as much of a $38 million gap. It could be much smaller. We just don't really know. And there will be a lot of policy choices by the legislature that you face in what sort of schedule should we budget to? How much federal revenue do we want to count on, given the issues we saw in calendar year 24 with not necessarily even getting the amount that we are eligible for? So huge amounts of uncertainty on the Alaska Marine Highway, but again, a potential $38 million hole. That's kind of the worst case scenario. And finally, as I mentioned, there's ongoing employee bargaining negotiations on three unions that may increase costs. Another one that I think came up in the other body when Director Sanders presented was the child care. There's a group or a commission that did a task force, thank you, that had a series of recommendations that are due out. They're not funded now in the governor's budget. Assuming those recommendations are funded, that again could be an increased item. We don't have a good number for that because they haven't finalized the recommendations yet. So all this is to say that the governor's budget now with $1 billion deficit is likely a low starting point for where we'll end up at the end of session.
Okay, I think we'll need a little bit of hand on the Marine Highway, laying out the cash flow the last few years and then the forecasted FY24 end of the year in 25 budget to take a look at that. We spent some time on this issue last year trying to ensure that we had sufficient resources to absorb some unknown appropriation amounts that may come from the federal government, which American Samoa gave us a little haircut. So there is concern there. I think there's also a desire to make sure that we do our portion as appropriators to fund the Marine Highway. The management of the Marine Highway is another issue. So I think we'll have ample support to see that the Marine Highway is funded. We can have those conversations as we go forward. But if American Samoa got a piece of the pie last year, there's probably a good chance they'll get one this year too. We should prepare for some of that stuff. On the education, the 87.4, and then if we fail the test, 89, that's $176.5 million, just that one item, education, before we do other things in education. So do you plan on coming forward then with a more refined numeric after the supplementals so we can see which ones of these are plugged in, and then we can start trying to figure out how much funds we have to work with this next year's budget?
Mr. Chairman, yes, after the governor's amended budget, we'll see. I think some of these things will be refined by that submission. I think a lot of the items, just they didn't have firm numbers when they did the December budget, so we'll see Medicaid and other items built in, but there may be other items like that disparity test that we don't really have certainty about for quite a while.
So my understanding is if we don't fund the Medicaid, they get the services anyway and send us the bill. Has that changed from...
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So if we don't fund the full amount, then the payments would just get shifted to the following fiscal year. So they would just delay payment to providers.
Okay. Any other questions on this slide? We're going to slide 27.
All right. So going on to the long-term outlook and the governor's 10-year plan. So when the Legislative Finance Division is doing long-term modeling, our baseline is to assume that the adjusted base grows with inflation, but then also that all statewide items are funded to their statutory levels, because then you can say, as a policy choice, I'd like to have a different amount than the current statute. So that's our baseline. Then you can compare any policy choices against that. So with the baseline assumptions, we see deficits increasing from $1.1 billion in FY25 to a peak of $1.9 billion in FY31, and then decreasing a little bit. The governor's 10-year plan makes several policy changes relative to that baseline to reduce the deficit, but it still shows deficits each year. So it's not enough to end the deficits. So we'll start by showing a couple of models of just our baseline and then go to the governor's 10-year plan. So this is the first time I've shown this slide this year, so I'm going to take a minute to walk you through everything on it. This is our baseline model of our budget baseline with no overdraws from the ERA. First line shows our surplus and deficit. So we show a surplus for fiscal year 24 and then deficits from FY 25 to 33. On the left-hand side, we have a graph that the bars represent our revenue. So the blue bars are traditional revenue, oil and non-oil revenue. The green is our POMV revenue. The yellow is draws from our reserves, the CBR and SBR. The solid line here is our budget. So you can see on this graph there is a gap between our revenue and the budget. The first couple of years, that is made up by draws from our savings accounts. Those run out in FY27 in this scenario, and then we have an unfilled deficit. Again, this is showing that we don't draw that from the permanent fund just to get kind of a baseline for the size of the deficits before that happens. So you can see the gap there of an unfilled deficit. That's a plan that doesn't work. You can't have a unfilled deficit. We have to, by the Constitution, have a balanced budget. On the right, you can see our budget reserves. The gold at the bottom is the CBR and SBR. The green is the realized ERA balance. The realized ERA balance is declining in our baseline model. As we discussed a few slides ago, that's sort of the our baseline assumption with the permanent fund corporation's modeling is that would decline even if we're not drawing. We're leaving $500 million in the CBR for cash flow. So even after we draw, we leave that $500 million for cash flow. That's an assumption we've made for the last several years. At the bottom, you have the effective POMV draw rate. So if you include overdraws as part of the percent of market value draw, what are you actually drawing from the fund? This year, we're not. In this version of the model, we're not overdrawing. So it's just the statutory 5%. Then we show the PFD per person. Last year was $1,312. This shows our estimates for the statutory PFDs going forward from about $3,600 this year going to a peak of about $4,350 in FY33. Slide 29, we show what happens if you filled those deficits from the earnings reserve account. Again, we can't have unfilled deficits, so that's our largest savings account left. And we show that even that is not sufficient to get us through FY33 based on this baseline. We would have a broken plan by FY33 and a zero balance in the earnings reserve account. You can see those additional overdraws leading to higher effective POMV draws in those later years because we're overdrawing the ERA. And you know, these are, again, kind of doom and gloom scenarios. These are assuming you'll do nothing. As we've seen way back at that first slide, the legislature has not run the budget that way. We have varied things, mostly the PFD and the capital budget, to ensure that we're not running big deficits. But again, if we follow those current statutes, this is what would happen. Okay, going on to slide 30. So the governor's 10-year plan has a number of, or a couple of policy changes. So in our default, in our baseline model, we assume that agency operations in the capital budget grow at 2.5%, which is our inflation assumption. The governor assumes they grow at 1.5% based on restricting the growth in government. He also does not include in his 10-year plan funding for community assistance with unrestricted general funds after FY25. So they have that in FY25, but not in future years. There's a few assumption differences that between our model and the 10-year plan. The first is that the governor assumes that supplementals and lapsing funds cancel each other out. We include a $50 million placeholder for supplementals. While our actual supplementals are often a lot higher than that, we also, with the unfilled positions in particular, have significant lapsing funds every year that partially cancel those out. That $50 million is based on sort of a pre-COVID average. Since COVID, our lapse and supplementals have both been extraordinarily volatile. So the last few years, it's hard to really get a baseline. So that's kind of the baseline we had in the more normal years in the past. We also include a placeholder for new school debt after the moratorium ends in July 2025. The governor doesn't include a placeholder for that. He's just running the existing debt table out. We assume that once the moratorium ends, there's new debt that would come online. Our estimate is that there's $7.8 million of new state obligations each year based on the amount of new debt that school districts were incurring before the moratorium. So it's a historical number. It's possible that number would be higher because school districts will have built up needs. It's also possible that because of the state's history of not fully funding that obligation, some school districts may be less interested in that program than they were before. I don't know, so we're just using that historical number in the absence of information about how they'll behave. Finally, the Department of Revenue's Fall Revenue Sources book used a preliminary number from the Permanent Fund Corporation, and that was reflected in the governor's 10-year plan. That number actually didn't end up even getting published. We're using the figures from the Permanent Fund Corporation's November History and Projections Report. That's a published number that we can match. We can't match theirs based on anything public. So we're, in our modeling, not matching it. We're just using what's public. So the result of that is actually higher POMV numbers by about $100 million a year. So all these other two assumption differences result in a larger deficit. That results in a smaller deficit in future years because we're using those published numbers from November.
Senator Wilson. Okay. Anybody else? Question on this one? For those watching at home, we've seen this quite often. There's some anomalies every year, but the base model, we've seen it over and over. So that's probably one reason why the committee members aren't firing off a lot of questions. We've gone over this year after year after year. And the model doesn't change too much. So, but we'll have these models back in front of the public when we get a better idea we get past February 14th, when we see the governor's always amendments and the adjustments. We'll bring it all back. Okay, continue on.
So, Mr. Chairman, slide 31 compares the governor's 10-year plan to the legislative finance baseline. So, again, the biggest difference is really just growing. How fast is the budget growing? 2.5% or 1.5%? It doesn't sound like a huge difference, but compound interest is a very powerful force, and that goes from a pretty small difference in FY25 just based on the governor's budget being less than, especially the capital budget being less than the previous year. But then the difference grows over time to a nearly $700 million difference by FY33, again, just based on that growth rate. So the growth rate is, well, and the community assistance, but primarily that growth rate. So that growth rate is actually pretty powerful in terms of determining the size of the budget, but it's as we'll see, that change alone is not sufficient to balance the budget.
And I think, just as a reminder, although this has been mentioned before, I think the committee will be focusing much narrower than over 10 years because of the substantial deficits we're facing if we do nothing, which we're not going to do. So we'll be reining in some of this analysis out 2 or 3 years in front of us.
So the governor's 10-year plan on slide 32, in our model, we show pretty similar numbers to theirs because our assumption differences kind of balance out. They show a deficit of about $1 billion in FY25, shrinking slightly, then growing to a peak of $1.5 billion. And so in the governor's 10-year plan as submitted, they show the CBR being drawn to, I think, negative $10 billion by FY33. The requirement in the statute for the 10-year plan is to balance it says that the budgets, the 10-year plan has to balance the sources of revenue and expenditures and fund balances. I'm not sure that running the CBR to negative $10 billion follows that statute, but that sort of statute is kind of a suggestion. But his 10-year plan does not really provide a full fiscal solution. It just runs the CBR negative. Our model, we're not running it negative. We just show an unfilled deficit. So in our default here, we're showing unfilled deficits pretty similar to theirs that we would show the FY27. We wouldn't have enough in the CBR to fully balance the budget. And then going forward beyond that, we'd have unfilled deficits. So again, pretty similar to if you look at the 10-year plan document in our model. But again, the 10-year plan does not really fully close the deficits, although, as you'll see, those deficits are smaller than in our baseline model because of those policy changes that he is proposing. Slide 33, if you choose to fill those deficits out of the earnings reserve account rather than leaving them unfilled, it would draw the ERA down, not to zero, unlike in the baseline, but it would still draw it down where the combined ERA and CBR balance would be about $2.5 billion by FY33 if you pulled extra from the ERA each year to meet those deficits. So, again, unlikely the legislature would do this, but this is, if you take the 10-year plan literally, this is what she would result in.
And I think we'll also want to tie in the permanent fund market value when we advance this discussion over the next couple months so we can watch the impact of that for future Alaskans. Any other?
Mr. Chairman, we reached the end. We made it through all 34 slides, so.
And we have any final questions, concerns? This is just preliminary data. We'll have these freshened up as we get updated numerics out of the governor over the next several weeks. So this will conclude our meeting this morning. We're going to reconvene at 1:30 today. We're going to Senator Olson will be chairing. We're going to bring back Senate Bill 127, taxation, vehicle rentals, and subpoenas, I guess. I don't know if that's a first hearing or not. But clearly on the retirement system, SB 88, we'll bring that back. So we'll have a meeting reconvening at 1:30 today. We are adjourned at 10:37 a.m. We are adjourned.